Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1978, and the presenter was Roy Plumley.
This week, our castaway is the writer, Colin Wilson. Colin, I know you're interested in music. You have a big collection of records, haven't you?
Yes, I've about 15,000.
15,000?
I started to buy them when The Outsider came out, as soon as I could afford to buy records, and they've just gone on accumulating.
15,000. Now, if you wanted to sit down and play all those, it would take you quite a long time.
Yes, I worked out about 3 years, playing 10 hours a day.
Well, we're just going to spend about 35 minutes now. Your first record for Desert Island, what's it going to be?
Since one of my main interests is opera, I have a large opera collection, I'd like a bit of Wagner to start off with, not a lifelong obsession, a bit of Rheingold, the storm music.
An excerpt from the recording of Wagner's Das Rheingold, directed by George Schulte, and we heard the voice of Eberhard Wächter. What part of the country are you from, Colin?
I'm from the Midlands, from Leicester.
Now, your father worked in a factory there, a shoe factory.
Yes, he was in the boot and shoe trade all his life.
Now, you became, as a child, a voracious reader. What inspired that?
I'm not sure. I've always been a kind of romantic, I suppose.
What sort of things did you read, first of all?
Escapist fiction, things like King Solomon's Mines. Mm. And then, at the age of 10, I became fascinated by science fiction. This got me interested in science, and from then on, the only thing I wanted to do was to become a scientist. I wanted to work on the atomic bomb, but I never got a chance. They invented it just as I reached the right age.
You started to write very early, too.
Yes, I think I wrote my first story at the age of 8, but I started to write my first book at the age of 13. It was an enormous compilation that was an attempt to summarise all of the scientific knowledge in the world.
Oh, very modest enterprise. So that was already your ambition? That's what your career was going to be, writing?
No, I wanted to be a scientist. And I continued to want to be a scientist until I was 16, when I left school.
No one suggested you should stay on at school and go further?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. It isn't the kind of thing that gets suggested somehow, or at least it wasn't then. Somehow it was taken for granted that I left school at 16 and started to work, and besides, my father kept saying that he didn't want me lazing around the place anymore.
What was your very first job?
When I left school, I worked in a warehouse, a wool warehouse, for a couple of months. And I must say, I hated it. I've always hated work.
And after that?
Then I went back to school as a lab assistant, and soon found that I'd lost interest in science in the 2 months that I'd been away from school, when I spent all the time in my bedroom reading romantic poetry in an attempt to reconcile myself to work.
What was the next step?
Well, they threw me out of the lab assistant's job when they found that I wasn't really interested. And so I then began to do any kind of job. I worked in the civil service in various offices.
Doing what?
I finally became an established civil servant in taxes.
Collecting taxes?
Yes, I was in the collector of taxes in Leicester.
A shameful period of your life.
Well, I spent most of it reading. I had a very tolerant boss who was really delightful.
Yes.
And who didn't in the least mind walking through the office and seeing that I was reading Shaw or whatever.
Let's break here for your second record. What's that to be?
I'd like to hear an old favourite, Yves Montand, singing a song called Et la fête continue, because it's one of the gayest and jolliest songs that I know.
Et vous verrons, puis disparaît dans le soleil, sans régler les consommations. Disparaît dans le soleil, tout en continuant sa chanson. La 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 la.
Yves Montand, et la fête continue. So, you were collecting taxes and still, of course, reading and writing.
Mm.
Were you submitting anything you wrote by now?
Yes, I'd sent off a few things, but I always found that I got so completely miserable when they were promptly rejected that I finally stopped sending things off. I have an absolute hatred of being rejected.
Those were the days of national service. You were called up.
Mm, into the RAF.
What did you do there?
Well, I was a clerk, and I only spent 6 months in the RAF. Then I managed to get myself thrown out by claiming that I was homosexual.
And that's a shrewd move.
It was almost accidental. I was so sick of it, I hated it. And they threw me out, and I decided that I would never again be tied down, that if I had to become a tramp and wander around the lanes, I'd rather do that than settle back in an office again.
You did go tramping for a bit in France, didn't you?
Yes, I tramped around England too. But I'm a sort of typical home lover, you know, I'm a Cancer. And I didn't really find that I enjoyed wandering around with a knapsack and nowhere to sleep.
What were you planning to do? Had you started thinking about your first book, The Outsider?
Oh, yes. I'd always intended to be a writer. And I'd started to write a novel at that time, a novel that later became Ritual in the Dark, which at that stage was about a man who thinks but is not certain that he's committed a murder in a sort of state of semi-amnesia. This eventually turned into Ritual in the Dark, but only after another 10 years.
Yes, you didn't finish it at that time.
No, in fact, not only did I not finish it, I somehow couldn't get into it. I wanted it to be an enormous novel, full of all kinds of interesting cross-references, full of all kinds of ideas, and finally there were so many cross-references and ideas that the thing was completely overwhelmed. It was like an overweighted boat.
And then came The Outsider.
Well, no, what happened was that I finally decided that the sensible thing to do was to take all the cross-references and ideas and the sort of Joycean erudition and so on out of it, stick that in a separate book, and confine myself in the novel simply to a straightforward story. And the separate book became The Outsider.
Which is an extraordinary book to have been written by a young man. What were you, 23? 24?
I was 22 when I started it, yes.
And especially a self-educated young man of 22. In order to get it done, you went on really short commons. You were camping out for a while, weren't you?
Well, what happened was that I decided at a certain period that the sensible thing would be not to pay rent all the time, because obviously this was taking far too much money. I thought that if I had a tent, this would save rent, so I bought a tent and tried putting this up on Hampstead Heath, but that attracted too much attention, so I ended by simply having a waterproof sleeping bag and sleeping out on the heath, and then going down the hill to the British Museum in the morning, every morning, and writing The Outsider there.
How long did it take?
Not very long. I started sketching the thing out in the Christmas of 1954. A lot of it had been written by early 1955, at which point I sent a big chunk of it off to Victor Gollancz, because I thought he'd be sympathetic. In fact, he did accept it, but at this point my mother became very ill, had peritonitis, and so I broke off the book and kept rushing up and down to Leicester to see her. I didn't finish it, therefore, until late August or early September. But Gollancz had already told me by that time that he would accept it when it was finished.
It was accepted then by the first publisher you sent it to?
Yes, accepted on the strength of the first half dozen pages, virtually.
What's your third record?
One that reminds me very much of this period. Fred Astaire singing Something's Gotta Give. On the day when I got the letter from Gollancz saying that he would publish The Outsider, I went out to the cinema in the Haymarket with my girlfriend Joy. We went to see the film Daddy Longlegs with Fred Astaire and Leslie Caron, and I remember the tremendous feeling of gaiety that suddenly came over me as I listened to this Something's Gotta Give with these blaring trumpets in the middle of it. It brings it back very strongly.
Thank you. irresistible force such as you meets an old immovable object like me. You can bet as sure as you live, something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give.
Fred Astaire, Something's Gotta Give. So now, at 24, you were a celebrity. The Outsider is a serious book, a difficult book, a rather gloomy book. Would I be right in thinking that it was talked about rather more than it was read?
Very probably. You see, what happened was that on the day that The Outsider was reviewed, John Osborne's Look Back in Anger was also reviewed. The two of us, as it were, achieved this notoriety together. We were instantly linked together as angry young men.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the press had a sort of literary new generation to write about. And it was the silly season of the year. This was early June. And the consequence was that quite suddenly we were in the news all the time for thoroughly silly and trivial reasons. They'd ring me up and say, what do you think about the seams in ladies' stockings?
What did you follow it with? Had you got one already in your mind to follow it with?
Well, yes. I'd originally intended The Outsider to go on to various mystics and religious figures, and there simply wasn't room, so they're all squashed into the last chapter of The Outsider. And so I allowed myself to expand into the second book, a thing called Religion and the Rebel, which came out 18 months later. But of course, interestingly enough, by this time there had been a complete backswing. In fact, this had begun to occur about 3 weeks after The Outsider came out. People were saying, oh, this is just a mishmash of quotations. And so the consequence was the second book was slaughtered. It was panned. Philip Toynbee, who had hailed The Outsider, said that the second book was a rubbish bin. And, of course, it stopped selling.
What effect did that have on you?
Well, in a funny sort of sense, it was an effect of relief. You see, I'd always believed that I had genius. I'd always believed this ever since the age of about 10. But suddenly, having people saying, yes, yes, you know, you are a man of genius, worried me. I thought I must have been wrong. And now suddenly, I was in a situation I once again recognised. I was back on my own, back in this situation of working away alone. By this time, I'd moved to Cornwall, because old Gollancz said, for God's sake, get out of London or you'll never write another book. And so suddenly, there was this strange feeling of quiet and solitude. Luckily, Joy was an ideal sort of person to be with anyway. You know, the sort of solid, steady background. And I found that I enjoyed living in the country and simply working away.
Record number 4 we've got to.
Mm. Well, this was the time when I started buying records in quantity. And the Beethoven quartets were very much a favourite. Beethoven always impressed me because he was one of those people who continued to develop, didn't stop, and this struck me as the enormous challenge. I like the scherzo of his last quartet, Opus 135, simply because he makes the violinists work so hard.
Of the second movement of the Beethoven Quartet, Opus 135, by the Amadeus Quartet. Are you a compulsive writer?
I suppose, yes. At least I'm a compulsive worker. This is not sort of necessarily a good thing. I find that at times it brings a tremendous strain. In fact, I almost had a nervous breakdown in 1973, just because whenever I'm faced with some challenge, I tend to grip my teeth a bit too hard and sort of grind into it, and the consequence is that I can run down. In other words, I've never really learned to relax as I should. I'm having to learn this sort of rather slowly and painfully.
Are you disciplined? Do you work regular hours? Get up at the same time every morning?
More or less. I seldom go down to my workroom until about 11 in the morning, but then I tend to work straight through the day until 5 o'clock, go and have a hot bath, and then pour myself a glass of wine and watch the TV news.
Now, you've written about 30 non-fiction books now, a dozen or so novels, a few plays. Now, your novels, ostensibly spy stories, detective stories, science fiction, they're not quite what they seem.
What I always wanted to do was to use the novel as a form of propaganda, if you like, so that I always tended to write a novel in tandem with a non-fiction book, as I'd started doing accidentally with Ritual in the Dark and The Outsider, one of which explicates the other, and I've continued to do this, so that book after book has been linked with another novel with a non-fiction book.
Record number 5.
Well, I'd like the opening movement of Eric Coates's London Suite, the Covent Garden bit, partly because it reminds me of old Gollancks and his office in Covent Garden, partly because I love in music this kind of fizzy vitality that Coates gets into the music here.
Covent Garden from Eric Coates's London Suite. A few years ago, Colin, you wrote a long book, The Occult, really a history of occultism, and you've just followed that up with, well, a sequel, really, Mysteries, which is even longer. Have you had any supernatural experiences yourself?
No, not at all, except for telepathy and one or two other things like this that I describe in The Occult, you know, actually with my wife or children. Nothing. I'm what you might call ESP thick.
What's on the stocks next? What are you going to write? Or what are you writing?
I've written a book on Wilhelm Reich, which is the next major thing, and then I've been working for
tell
years.
Tell us who Wilhelm Reich is.
Yes, Reich was the psychologist who believed that sexual frustration is the basis of all neurosis, which I think is absolute nonsense. But at the same time, he was such a curious and fascinating character and came to such a tremendously sad end. But I've been studying him for years with deep interest, and I've now finally finished a book about him. But the book that I've really been preoccupied with for a long time now, for more than 20 years, is an enormous novel called Lulu. The original idea was that Lulu, who was a character in two plays by Frank Wedekind, is a woman who's completely irresistible to men and who destroys every man she comes into contact with, and yet does it with total innocence and has no intention whatever of destroying them. It's, as it were, this archetypal feminine principle that draws men like moths into a candle flame. Finally, two or three years ago, the BBC asked me if I had an idea for a good novel, a big novel, that could be serialised as a television serial, and I proposed Lulu. So they've now actually commissioned it, and after 20 years I'm going to be forced to go ahead and write it. I've got one enormous problem which is really holding me up, and that is the fact that all my novels so far have covered a very short time period, sometimes a mere 24 hours, and I've followed them with a camera, so to speak, inch by inch. Now I've got a whole year to do, and I've spent the first 200 pages of this novel describing something less than its first 24 hours. So you see, at this rate, the thing will be thousands of pages long.
You have problems.
It is a technical problem indeed, yes.
Record number 6.
I'd love to hear Bix Beiderbecke's Jazzmee Blues, because Bix Beiderbecke is one of the few jazzmen that I've always loved very much, and again, this enormous nostalgia of the early period in London, Soho, that Bix reminds me of.
Thank you. Jazzy Blues by Big Spiderbeck and his gang, recorded in 1927. In your youth, Colin, you had this long spell of camping out on Hampstead Heath. How do you feel about doing it again under rather tougher conditions under tropic skies? Could you look after yourself?
Probably, yes.
Could you face solitude?
This is the basic idea of The Outsider. I think I could. I once wrote a novel called The Black Room, which was about this question. How could we strengthen the mind to spend all our time in total solitude, if necessary?
You live on the Cornish coast, so you should know a little bit about fishing.
I'm not very good at it. I hate the sea.
No good with small craft?
Well, we gave away our boat a few weeks ago because I hadn't used it for years.
Would you try to escape?
Yes, very probably. I have this persistent tendency to look for solutions to problems.
We got to your seventh record.
A piece from Kurt Weill's Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, the piece Rashungen's Hay, which I love because it has this sort of superb marching music feeling about it. It's funny that Weill and Brecht should have been communists. They should have been Nazi marching music.
Rashungen's Hay, Rashungen's Hay, steckt ihn an den Sand von Mandalay.
An item from Kurt Weill's Mahagoni. And now your last record.
What I'd love to end with is the last chunk of the opera by Gilbert Beco, who, as you know, is basically a French pop singer, called the Aron Opera, and which I've always loved and always thought has been unfairly dismissed. It was a flop, in fact, when it was presented. I think that this end bit, where the boat sails out to sea bearing the girl Maureen and the awful Italian Angelo and the boyfriend yells Angelo from the shore, is really tremendous dramatic stuff.
Closing passage of Gilbert Beco's Opéra de Rennes. Now, you said it was a flop, Colin. It is still being done quite a lot in French provincial opera houses.
So it
still lives. Now, one disc out of your eight, if you could only take one.
If I could only take one, I'd like the Beethoven, if I could have the whole quartet, Opus 135.
Oh, yes, of course you do. Mm. And one luxury?
Well, I suppose wine, as much as you'll allow me to have.
A reasonable supply. What kind of wine?
Beaujolais, probably.
Splendid.
A good Beaujolais.
And one book, apart from the Bible and Shakespeare and big encyclopedias.
I'd be tempted to take Shaw's Complete Plays, but I know those so well that I think maybe Doughty's Arabia Deserta, which is a book that I've often tried to read from beginning to end and never quite made it.
Doughty's Arabia Deserta. And thank you, Colin Wilson, for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
Goodbye, everyone.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Thank you.